You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gravey. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gravey. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world, a world where our food is free of GMOs and harmful chemicals. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. Our website is foodintegritynow.org, and you can also find us on Facebook at Food Integrity Now and on Twitter, and we also have a YouTube channel. We appreciate you listening today. My guest today is Professor Tyrone Hayes. He is a professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. In 1997, he was hired by a company which later became known as the agribusiness giant Syngenta. They asked him to study the effects of atrazine, a widely used pesticide that is applied to 50% of the corn in the U.S. It's used on golf courses and at Christmas tree farms. Today, we're going to be speaking with Professor Hayes about those findings and how Syngenta tried to silence him because of those findings. Professor Hayes, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, you're welcome. So can you tell us a little bit more about your background, and then we'll have you share with us how you were first approached to do this research on atrazine?
Sure. Well, I grew up in South Carolina. I've had an interest in biology and the environment and how it affects development and health for a long time. I did my undergraduate work at Harvard, where I pursued an interest in biology and environmental sciences, and then I came to Berkeley for my PhD, where I specifically studied endocrinology and the role of environment in regulating hormones and how hormones then regulate development and reproduction and growth and virtually every aspect of an animal or a person's life. At some point, just after I became a professor here at the University of California, Berkeley, I started studying the effects of chemicals that interfere with hormones on growth and development and reproduction. And eventually I was approached by Novartis to join a panel to study the herbicide atrazine and to examine its effects as an endocrine disruptor on amphibians.
Okay, and Novartis is now, well, the company now is Syngenta.
Correct. At the time, Novartis was the manufacturer of atrazine, but in the year 2000, the company split, and Novartis does pharmaceuticals, and Syngenta does the agrochemicals.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's just get right to it. What were your findings?
Well, initially we found that atrazine decreased the size of the larynx or the voice box in exposed male frogs, and this was an indication that atrazine was somehow limiting testosterone production, the male hormone, during development. Towards the end of my tenure, when I was on contract as a consultant for Novartis, we also discovered that there were abnormalities in the gonads, which in the reproductive organs, which would explain the low testosterone and the small larynx. So the voice box or the larynx is dependent on testosterone in frogs, just like it is in humans. Those abnormalities we found, those deformities of the reproductive organs, included males that developed ovaries or that developed multiple testes, and we hypothesized that atrazine was having this effect because it induces an enzyme called an aromatase. Aromatase is the machinery, if you will, that converts testosterone into estrogen. So males would become both demasculinized because they would lose their testosterone, as well as feminized because they would start producing estrogen when they were exposed to this compound. Eventually, we went on to show many other effects and this study in much more detail, but that's the work that I produced while as a consultant for Novartis.
Okay, when you first shared your findings with the company, what was their initial response?
Well, initially, when I first, when we first started producing the preliminary data, there was some concern. But as any good group of scientists would do, they suggested that we repeat the experiments, that we increase the sample size, and explore whether or not the effect was real or an artifact of small sample size. And so we promptly did that, maybe faster than they wanted us to, but we promptly produced those data. And at that stage, I suggested that we replicate or redo the entire experiment to make sure, because sometimes, there could be random errors, so to make sure it was repeatable. And the company had agreed to that, but then the company and the panel really started to, distribute the funds slowly. And, I also requested that we talk to scientists outside of our group, to look for more expertise outside of the area. I wanted to present the work to other scientists the way you do when you do science as an academic. And, there was just no interest in publishing or making available or, sending the data to the Environmental Protection Agency like they were supposed to. There was really no interest into exploring the data, certainly not in any efficient way. But there were many offers to provide me the funding as long as I would kind of slow down and keep things quiet. And I became very uncomfortable with that. They eventually brought in a guy named Charles Breckenridge, who suggested that we manipulate the data, for example, by dividing the size of the laryngeal, the larynx muscle, by the body weight. And, I promptly showed that that was an inappropriate measure that was actually burying the data. And eventually I left the panel. I became very uncomfortable. And then they brought in a statistician, and they brought in other reviewers claiming that, the statistics weren't done properly and that maybe we made mistakes in how we calculated the data. And, they really tried to railroad me in front of my, I invited them here at Berkeley. They tried to get me to come to the company, and I said, no, I'm not going to fly out there, and no, I'm not going to accept, it was a large sum of money to continue to research, but you can come here at Berkeley. And eventually, as they went on to, when they couldn't find real problems with the science, they really went on to badger me and to, attack me personally, and that's now all been revealed in their company notes, the lengths that they went through and the money that they spent on trying to discredit me personally and as a professional.
So they basically asked you in the beginning to manipulate the data.
Correct. Yes, that was one of their strategies, was to manipulate the size of the muscle that we had measured by dividing by body weight. And I could demonstrate very clearly. I mean, my little daughter at the time was only a few years old, and I could demonstrate that I could measure my calf muscle and her calf muscle, and mine was obviously bigger. But if you divide by body weight, I could make her look bigger than me. So I clearly showed them that this was an inappropriate measurement, that you were really sort of hiding or fudging the data. And not only that, that they continued to try to get me to do it, but when they produced their own data, I happen to know that they sent data like that to the EPA, manipulated in that way. And I know that because the EPA shared their documents with me. So there were, in fact, some of the confidential documents, including their preliminary and raw data, the EPA, it's probably illegal, but the EPA actually shared their documents with me. So I knew that they were still up to the same tricks even after I left the panel.
Well, I think a lot of people believe that the EPA conducts most of their own studies, and that's not true, is it?
There are some EPA laboratories, but it's a very interesting setup. So, for example, the EPA has done some actually quite damaging work showing that atrazine has adverse effects on mammals, but when the regulatory side of the EPA holds their panels, the research labs aren't allowed to actually come and present their data to the regulatory side of the EPA. It's a very strange setup. So I've actually witnessed Syngenta scientists presenting and sort of really downplaying and being really critical of data that were generated by the EPA laboratories. But those scientists that work for the EPA, for whatever reason, aren't allowed to present themselves or to even defend their data. So it's a very interesting arrangement that I don't quite understand why it's in place the way it is.
So the panel you were speaking about, was that the EcoRisk panel?
I was a member of the EcoRisk atrazine assessment panel, correct. And that was a group that the company since gone out of business. I like to think it had something to do with me and the atrazine, because it was really sort of a shabby thing set up to promote industry's products. I mean, it was really set up to, generate good data and make their products look good. And I didn't know at the time, that I signed up for it. I thought it was a really independent panel that received money for industry, but that's really not what it was at all.
Right. And I got some of this information from the article that was in the New Yorker that was earlier this year. And wasn't that in February of this year, where you talk about, or the author talks about, how this information was presented to this panel, and they evaluated 17 studies, and 12 of the 17 studies were conducted by Syngenta.
Well, that reference is actually to the EPA's panel. So the Environmental Protection Agency has a scientific advisory panel, and that panel advises the EPA on whether or not, for example, a chemical should be studied more or regulated. I could see how you'd be confused, however, because some people served on both the EPA's panel as well as on Syngenta's panel. So there's a, you know, there's a revolving door there. So for example, this guy Klaus Werner, who's done all this research for Syngenta and served on their panel, was also a member of the EPA's panel. So there's really a lot of problems in how the system's set up. So you have a guy who, for example, this guy Klaus Werner, who sat on the EPA panel and who said, yeah, more data needs to be produced and Syngenta needs to pay for it. And then he turned around and took money from Syngenta. So he benefited greatly financially from being on this panel, because he turned around and then started working for the company. There was also a guy, Ron Kendall, who was the head of the EcoRisk panel for Syngenta, for Novartis and Syngenta. And at the same time, he was the chair of the scientific advisory panel to the EPA. So he was both sitting on the panel for the EPA, who's supposed to be regulating the chemicals, and sitting on the panel for the company that's making money off of the chemicals. You know, so it's really sort of a strange setup with a lot of conflicts of interest.
Well, it's kind of the same old story of what's happening, you know, in so many of our government agencies like the FDA, where we have, you know, Michael Taylor and former employee of Monsanto. It's kind of the same situation. Were you threatened by Syngenta?
I was in many ways threatened, both personally and professionally. In particular, Tim Pasteur would come up to me at conferences and at talks and things, and or before I was testifying before the legislature, would whisper lewd comments. So he would make, you know, sexual innuendo, sexual comments in my ear, and would also threaten to, in one case he threatened to have me lynched, or, you know, he said something like, next time you give a talk on atrazine, I'm going to have some of my good old boys come and show you what it's like to be gay. He questioned whether or not my daughter and my wife were safe at home alone and if I should be traveling. And, you know, I've gotten letters from the lawyer about this, because I've actually quoted in verbatim the comments that he made to me. And I've gotten letters from their lawyer saying, well, it's slander and these things. But, you know, the comments were made, the most explicit comments were made in Illinois. And I think, you know, I think what the lawyer is going for, I think he's trying to get me to produce an alleged tape recording, because that would have been illegal in Illinois. But unfortunate for him, now the law that prevents you from making recordings that were protected safety has now been repealed. So it'll be interesting to see what their strategy is now.
Okay. And just for our listeners, who is Tim Pasteur?
Tim Pasteur is a senior scientist and employee of Syngenta. You know, one of the other things the lawyer said in their letter was, you know, he made these comments that I said they were following me around at conferences, and you know, and he kind of said that wasn't true. There were some of your public talks. But, you know, now I have documentation from Jane Thompson, the public relations firm that was working with Syngenta, and they very explicitly instructed Syngenta to gain access to my information, to my travel schedule, and to follow me around, and to, you know, present counter data to try to discredit me. It was in their writing. So, you know, it's not just my imagination. I knew that they were there. I saw them there. And now we have the documents in writing showing that they had been instructed. We now have emails between Tim Pasteur and their lawyer, Alan Nadel, congratulating Tim Pasteur for, you know, making these comments to me. These emails went back and forth between Jane Thompson, Alan Nadel, and two other law firms. So, you know, this was a clear strategy and a clear plan to really try to mess with my psychology before I was going off to give a talk or something like that.
Wow, so these are actually criminal acts that they were doing. Did you ever consider going to the authorities, or what were your thoughts when this was happening?
Well, yes. Yeah. So what happened, I actually didn't go to the authorities, but there was such a big concern by two of the senators in Illinois that the FBI was contacted. A police escort was assigned to me during much of my time in Illinois. And, you know, there was a report taken, and I was, you know, this police guard even went to the bathroom with me because of the comments that Tim Pasteur made. Those comments were overheard by a reporter and by some others, and the senator was notified. There was also police assigned to me here at Berkeley, because I received some packages and from a guy at Texas Tech who was working on the project. And I had law enforcement assigned to me here for my protection and for my family's protection. But I never took, I'm not, the way that I grew up, I'm not the kind of person that, we didn't call the cops where I grew up. So I mean, and somebody once, somebody asked me now, should I sue them for libel or for whatever? And, the real question is, okay, yeah, I could sue them, and I'm pretty sure we have all the evidence now, the hard evidence that this was planned. We know that they were there, they've been on videotape, and they've been taped otherwise. So the evidence is there, but, what would I sue for? And I asked somebody this recently, and they said, well, you'd get money. And I said, well, if I wanted money, I would have stayed with the company in the first place.
Right.
So I'm not the type of person that would, right? So, so what would I gain by that? What I would really go for and what I would really gain is to show what these people really did to me, and that's being done, right? I mean, it's being done on your show right now. It's been done on Democracy Now. It's been done in the New Yorker article. I just almost completed now a documentary on my relationship and what Syngenta did to me. There's another documentary we're filming starting, and there's potentially a feature film on this issue. So there's nothing I would gain from suing them. It's happening right now. For that matter, the documents are now becoming public. I'm certainly posting many of them on my Facebook. They're becoming public, and, justice is being done.
Right. And my guess is the threats have probably stopped for the most part because you've aired it.
They're laying low. The lawyer sent me this, really sort of funny letter about, if you don't stop giving these interviews and if you don't make a public apology, but they have nothing, we have in there. I mean, if you look at the New Yorker article, for example, the story was told from Syngenta's point of view, from their own documents, mm-hmm. from their own records. And, there's some hilarious, I think hilarious, there's a comment in the New Yorker from the Syngenta executive communications officer. And she says something like, I'm appalled that anyone would suggest that we would try to discredit Hayes or anyone for that matter. And, and right there in her handwritten documents, Sherry Ford writes down that their number one strategy under science is discredit Hayes. So, it's sort of funny. I'm not sure who you're trying to prove something to. You wrote it all down.
Well,
they told the story themselves. So.
They got caught with their pants down, and then they had to just back paddle. Sounds like
yeah.
Was your work ever published?
My work was published. We're continuing to publish work. We have a couple really nice and interesting papers coming out now showing further how much atrazine decreases testosterone in males. We have more field work, more field studies being published right now. We have other work related to different sensitivities of different populations coming out. So we're still very active and still going in the lab. Students are still working. We're still doing the science.
And have other scientists expanded on your work?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that's one of the things, too, that the company keeps saying, no one ever replicated Hayes' work. And this is absolutely not true. There are at least a half a dozen papers showing that atrazine causes sexual problems in frogs in the laboratory. There's another half dozen papers or so showing that atrazine is associated with reproductive abnormalities in frogs in the wild. There's papers on reptiles. There's papers on fish. There's papers on mammals, on rodents, on humans, all showing that atrazine causes reproductive problems. Most recently, a study just came out showing that atrazine is associated with abnormal reproductive development in humans. So women who are exposed to atrazine during pregnancy are more likely to have sons, whose penis doesn't grow or whose testicles don't descend into the scrotum or whose penis develops abnormally. And that's completely consistent with the sexual abnormalities that we observe in wildlife and in laboratory animals. So the data are out there. I mean, it's not looking good for atrazine or for Syngenta, which is why they became, are still so desperate to try to discredit me personally because they know they can't tear down the science. If they can tear down the man or focus more attention on me, then I think they think that people won't look at all these other data that are out there.
Yeah, and Syngenta sells more than $14 billion worth of seeds and these pesticides a year. So they have a lot of money at stake here.
They do.
And, atrazine is the number two selling herbicide in the world. It's only second to glyphosate, which
That's
is
correct.
The active ingredient in Roundup. We've done many shows on this with lots of great experts. And I've spoken with other scientists who believe that their scientific research is being attacked by these corporations in a similar manner. Do you think that independent science is at risk because so many of these studies are industry funded and the fact that these corporations give so much money to the university? It seems like that's a great conflict of interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not new. I mean, I've talked to many people, Fred Von Saal, Theo Kolborn, might recall the way that Rachel Carson was attacked. And, you know, these are people who it's a mindset that I don't understand. You know, I mean, I was raised in a way that, I don't know how you can have one ethic at work and one ethic at home, or maybe they raise their children in such an unethical manner that, I mean, you know, so for example, one of the things I've seen in their handwritten notes, they wrote down, I think this was in 2004, Sherry Ford wrote down that terbutalazine was a more potent than atrazine. It caused the same problems but at lower doses, and that it was associated with a number of different cancers in rats and poor survivorship. And this is the chemical that they released in Europe to replace atrazine. So before the chemical even went out, they had a meeting where they discussed that this chemical was worse. One, they're acknowledging that atrazine is bad for the environment, but now they're acknowledging that they're releasing a chemical that does the same thing as atrazine. They wrote that, quote, does the same thing as atrazine, but at lower doses. So how do you have an ethic like that? How do you go to work and write notes saying that, okay, we know we're going to release this bad chemical, but it's going to make us more money, and then go home and feed your children and take care of your children and your family and your parents? That's just, you know, I just wasn't raised that way. And it's all about the dollar, I presume. Maybe they're protecting their families in ways that don't reflect how little care they have about the environment and about public health, and really about the farmers, about the growers that are buying their seed and buying these chemicals. I just can't understand. And mutually so. If you look through their notes, you'll see over and over again they keep writing, what's motivating Hayes? Who's paying Hayes? They can't fathom that somebody would do something because it's just right, that there has to be somebody paying me, you know.
That's a very good point there, because I think a lot of these corporations, their motivation is greed and not human health. And they can't fathom that somebody would not take money to virtually lie.
Yeah.
And they don't get that.
Yeah. I keep reading this thing all over, you know, because they generated this Wikipedia page that was just full of lies. I mean, talk about libel. You know, and one of the things they said was that I was a high-paid expert witness for, you know, these lawsuits. I've never been paid. That the lawyer Steve Tillery, who they just lost $105 million to, took me out to lunch once. That's it. I've never received any money for any of the work that I did for the law firms or for anybody. The only person, and I take pride in saying this, the only entity that's ever paid me personally to study atrazine was Novartis Syngenta. Nobody else has ever given me any personal money. I've never gotten any financial personal gain from atrazine, ever, to this day. So, and that person who was funding me, I walked away from. Mm-hmm. I'd be much better off financially, both personally and professionally, had I stayed with Syngenta. They've spent tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars now. A fraction of that money could have been mine, and you know, I could retire now, fix the roof and deck of my house.
you could retire, but given what I know about you, you wouldn't sleep at night.
that's not going to happen.
So let's talk about the class action suit that was brought by 23 Midwestern cities and towns.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know about that prior to this article coming out in the New Yorker?
Yes, I did. I first heard about the lawsuit, oh, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but we held a meeting in Iowa. It was funded by the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, NIEHS, and we held a meeting in Iowa, actually where I invited Syngenta and all these guys, so let's have a big meeting and talk about the science of atrazine. And at that meeting, I was approached by a lawyer who told me about the lawsuit. So I knew about it. That was more than 10 years ago. There were several points during the lawsuit where I talked to lawyers and I did a literature search and provided the scientific literature that was some of the basis for the lawsuit. I sort of did summaries, you know, layman summaries of the science that was available. And I participated in a couple of conference calls where we talked about the science and atrazine's effects on wildlife and humans. But I was never paid for any of that work. I was told what my fee would be. I don't even remember now. And I told the lawyers that it was a matter of civic duty for me, that I would never take money for, you know, providing information and knowledge for a cause like the one that they were working for. So I never received any money for my services in that regard.
And in that lawsuit, they accused Syngenta of concealing the dangers of atrazine and really contaminating their drinking water.
And Syngenta has done that. I mean, atrazine is the most common chemical contaminant of drinking water, of groundwater, rainwater, surface water, you name it.
And so the European Union banned it until further studies.
That's correct. Right about the same time that my data came out and was published, right about the same time that the EPA started to re-review atrazine, the European Union banned it because it contaminated so much of the water. And my understanding also, because France and some other countries had already banned it, including France, but because it travels in the rainwater for 1,000 kilometers, it was still in France's rainwater coming over from Germany. And so the European Union made a decision to ban atrazine in the Union.
Yet it's okay here. Until what, 2010? Is it going to be reevaluated at that time?
Oh, I didn't know that. But I would guess if it's reevaluated, there's even more data out now. I would guess that upon any reevaluation, it would still remain non-registered or banned in the European Union.
So, what do you think about our EPA? What does that say?
I don't have a lot of confidence. I was very naive when I first got involved in this. I thought, once the EPA has the data. But, one of the shocking things that, well, wasn't shocking to me because I already knew this. If you read the article in the New Yorker, the EPA, the person who spoke for the EPA says that they weigh out things like shortened life and disease and, health problems, and they weigh that against the economic cost of getting rid of a chemical. So that's appalling to me that you would actually put that in print, that you would say that it's your policy, that if you know a chemical causes disease or health problems or shortened life, that you would weigh that against the cost, the economic benefits of that chemical. And I say it's appalling because the people who are paying that cost, the factory workers, the farm workers, who are mostly minorities, low-income, immigrant families, the people who are paying that cost are not the same people who are getting that economic benefit, right? I mean, this gets back to the 1% again, right? So it's the number of people who are making all the money on atrazine and these seeds are not the same people whose families are being harmed. They're not the same people whose babies are being born with prostate disease, who have a higher incidence and rate and death rate from breast cancer and from a number of other diseases that we know are associated with the chemicals that they're exposed to in their occupations and just in their lives in general because of where they live. I knew this. Right? I mean, it has to be the case. But for the EPA to actually admit, hey, this is what we're doing, just really blows me away that here we're in 2014 and somebody will still say something like that. Somebody who works for an agency that's called the Environmental Protection Agency would still make that comment, that we would knowingly leave the chemicals on the market because there's an economic benefit to having them there.
Are you familiar with the book Poison Spring?
I am not, actually.
It's a book, and I can't think of the author's name. He's Greek, so it's a long name. And I think it's a fairly new book, and he is a former EPA employee, now turned whistleblower. I'm going to try and see if I can get him on the show after I read his book. But I listened to an interview with him on another program and very interesting information on the EPA. I think you might find it interesting as well.
Okay.
What do you think needs to happen for there to be more independent studies done on these chemicals and to have this work validated and recognized more widely by the scientific communities? What do you think the answer is?
I think we're in danger, and I think we're facing much more danger in that regard because federal funding for basic science is decreasing. Not only is federal funding for National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health decreasing, but many of the organizations like the National Science Foundation won't fund studies that have an applied objective. So they won't fund studies that examine endocrine disruption, for example. And so as we continue to, I mean, think about what's happening here, the unwritten collaboration. As the EPA continues to keep chemicals on the market because of their economic benefit, that means that the companies that produce these chemicals are making more money. So now they have more money to control the regulation and the science and the studies that are being done. So we're taking away the capacity for laboratories like mine and others to do independent research, to do objective independent research that becomes public. We're reducing that capacity. We're increasing the capacity for industry to control the science and to control the regulation. I think we're in big trouble. On top of that, when the nonprofit organizations, like some of the organizations now that are supporting my laboratory, have to get involved because federal funding's been cut, then you've got industry will say, okay, see, he's working for the environmental activist groups and his science is tainted this way. So we really are headed for a very dangerous place in our history, a very dangerous place for environmental health and for public health, and we're losing the capacity to have science that advocates would use to protect our environmental health and public health.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I also think that it comes down to the individual, where we all have our own personal power, and I think if enough of us assist in educating others, and we can demand that these chemicals be removed from the environment, you know, before they do any further damage. And I know that sounds like a big job, but I personally believe that we can make it happen if enough of us get involved.
I agree. I also, though, from my perspective, we need the science as a weapon in that fight.
Exactly.
As we decrease the capacity to have independent science to be involved, then we're losing a big source of power for that grassroots movement. And I agree. I do my best to educate and get public involved and get non-academics and scientists involved, but I got to have the science in my pocket to do that.
Yeah.
Our ability to do that is decreasing.
Yeah, we do need the science. But I also think that there are still people out there that believe that our government will take care of us. And if agencies like the USDA and FDA and the EPA, that they believe that they're really there to protect us. And unfortunately, that's not the case anymore.
They should be, but that's not the case. There's too much influence of money and, I'm hopeful, but, I don't see any evidence of change.
Sometimes it's hard not to get discouraged, but we just keep getting the information out there and having great guests on the show, people who really care about the environment and human health and have the integrity and the tenacity to fight these corporations. So we thank you for being a guest on our show, and we really applaud your work and your integrity in the face of this giant corporation whose ultimate goal is profit with disregard for human and animal health. And I think that's just appalling.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, we appreciate, again, all the work you're doing, and we'll continue to follow your work. Thank you to our listeners. As always, we ask you to stay informed and be well, and we'll be back next week with another great show. Thanks for listening.